You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
Hi, it's Rod Adams here, and just wanted to give you a quick introduction on this show. Apologize for the background noise. As I discussed at the very beginning of the show with when I'm talking to Shane, I was sitting in a food court, and it was closing down. The rattling in the background is a man putting away the chairs and sweeping and moving his garbage can on wheels around on the tile floor. So, again, apologize for the background noise, but, hey, it's a pretty good show, so enjoy it. Take care. Bye. Good, Shane. How are you tonight?
Better than I was over the weekend.
Uh-oh.
My throat is still messed up.
Well, that's going to be a short show anyway, so that's I guess good timing.
Well, I'm taking antibiotics and slowly and surely shoving the gunk out of my system. So,
well, the good thing about the internet is it's not got to the point where it can transmit bacteria from person to person across the wires. So that's a good thing.
Because I really don't like spreading pestilence.
That's good. I prefer for you to keep it to yourself. So time is limited tonight, so let's go ahead and get started. This is Rod Adams, and I'm coming to you from a food court in, where am I today? I'm in Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay, and this is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lunas, New Mexico, and this is Atomic Show number 50.
Yep, 50. I decided not to make too big a deal about 50 because I'm really looking forward to 52, which is coming up very shortly. We'll be very, very close to exactly a one-year anniversary for us. We've thrown in a few extra shows along the way. But I think if I remember correctly, our first show was posted on March 9th, 2006. Now, tonight we had a couple of things that we want to talk about. This is going to be another one of those random food shows that we just kind of pull stuff out from most recent news and Google stuff. And I think we'll start off with the discussion that you wanted to introduce about the new dangerous radiation symbol that was introduced last week.
Okay, so the IAEA introduced a new symbol, which, as I've done some subsequent research, it's not quite as amenable to abuse as I thought it was. This symbol, if you look up new radiation symbol, red triangle, on Google or any search engine, it will take you to probably the IAEA.org website. And there you will see a picture of a red triangle with rounded corners pointing up, with the traditional radiation trefoil at the top, and then down at the lower left, a skull and crossbones, and then a giant arrow pointing to a running person, which one would imagine if you read the sign, considering there's no words on it, that it's trying to get across the point that radiation, in the circumstance that the sign is being viewed in, is grave danger. And this is meant for placement inside of irradiation shielding containers, so that if you started to try to take apart an irradiation unit, like a cobalt 60 unit, like you'd use for treating cancer, as was done in Brazil back in the 80s, they would come across this symbol and hopefully have some warning before they actually got into it and started taking the dose.
Yeah, so this symbol is not designed to be put, like, on the entrance to a facility or someplace where people would normally go. It's only designed to be put where you are the next step going to put yourself into significant radiation fields. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. This will be a supplement to the standard yellow and purple trefoil that has been known for many years as a symbol of a radiation area, a place where you need to monitor radiation. This is, like Shane said, designed to really protect people in the case of getting close to dangerous sources. And although Shane and I have made it clear to everybody that we're reasonably comfortable with radiation in low doses, we both recognize that we're not stupid. Radiation is definitely a dangerous physical phenomena, and we need to have ways to protect people. So I'm kind of in favor of this new symbol myself.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I thought at first it was going to be an opportunity for every anti-nuke in the country and outside to jump on the bandwagon saying that, hey, there's a new symbol we can parade about, talking about the various and sundry dangers of nuclear energy. And then after I read more about it and remembered some of the things that have happened, where, for instance, in Georgia, you blogged about this at some point in the past, several people got into a strontium-90 source from a discarded Russian RTG. And before that, back in the 80s, there was a case that the diarist in Nadir on the Daily Coast blogged about somewhat recently. It was a Brazilian girl who passed away because of radiation poisoning because her family had taken apart a irradiation machine that had a quantity of cesium-137 in it. And they took it apart, and because there was no warnings that they could understand on it, they saw this pretty blue, glittery ceramic inside, and they took it and started using it as decoration, and were selling it and using it to try to improve their lives, when, in fact, it was actually degrading their lives rather rapidly.
Yeah, rather rapidly.
That much 137 in that form, you're talking fatal dose in at most a couple hours.
Yep. It is, like I said, it's probably a good thing. Now, on the other hand, I was rather impressed by the amazing amount of effort that the IAEA, and you can translate effort into cost, IAEA put into developing the symbol. They tested it with 1,650 people getting feedback. They've been working on it for about 5 years, done a lot of research on exactly how to portray this symbol. So it definitely is an example of government studies at their finest.
Yep. Although there are... I imagine that they probably tried to cover as many bases as they could, but there are still probably going to be some cultures that this didn't make it into, or for whatever reason, this isn't going to reach everybody, but at least it's going to try to reach the largest group so that you can see this and see you are in deep doo-doo if you keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, of course, I have to admit, I did read that article that was attached to the symbol being launched. It was on the IAEA website, and I'll put a link in the show notes. It did make one statement that I'd like to challenge, and at least I'll set it my life's mission is. It says we cannot educate everyone about radiation, and maybe that's true, but we can sure try. So
radiation is not a particularly involved or difficult to understand phenomenon. I mean, it's light for all intents and purposes.
It's
light.
High-energy light.
Yeah. It's light that in sufficient doses can sunburn you in three dimensions rather than in two dimensions on your skin surface.
Right. Okay, so I got a couple other articles I want to talk about. Surprisingly enough, a French energy minister is trying to convince South Africa that they would be much better off abandoning their pebble bed modular reactors and buying great big French reactors.
I saw that. Now, that was interesting. So I wonder if it's I wonder what percentage of that offer is fear by Areva of the technology that's being developed by PBOMR, and how much of it is a realization of the size of the market, considering how much of that market is currently served by coal.
Well, you know, I'm not sure if Areva is afraid of the PBMR. I think it's rather typical salesmanship. You know, don't buy your own product, buy our product. You know, it's a, you know, France is a very large manufacturer of nuclear materials. I mean, they've got the only integrated from the mining to the disposal nuclear company in the world, and they certainly would prefer somebody to buy their product rather than making their own.
So. Yeah, I suppose. I guess I'm just trying to stir things up.
Well, you know, there, of course, you know, it's interesting. You know, this comment was, well, you've got a lot of power that you need, and it's much easier to do it in 1,600 megawatt increments, which is what the EPR is, rather than 160 megawatt increments. But, you know, it's the economies of mass production are something that seem to be completely lost to the nuclear industry and always have been. You know, making the same thing over and over again and figuring out how to make many of them rather than putting all your eggs in one basket is just, it's a foreign concept.
Yeah.
So, but that's okay. I think that South Africa's going to listen, nod, and maybe even buy a couple of the third generation or third generation plus reactors, but that's not going to slow them down on their desire for the PBMRs.
So I don't know if you saw this other news story that was on Nadir's page on COAST a couple days ago, but apparently the Japanese have brought up a new MOX processing plant that is capable of handling most of their used nuclear output from their light water reactor fleet. Something like 800 tons a year.
Oh, good.
And it's a process that is specifically designed to make sure that none of the fuel can be diverted.
Okay, now Japan doesn't do their own recycling, right? Don't they still send their fuel off to France or something, or UK, and get that separated?
Japan and France have had some trade going for some years, although the quantity of material that's going back and forth, even with the shielding, would make most freighter captains blush. You're asking me to carry that, and I can put that down in the bilge and carry.
Right, I can carry that in my stateroom, actually.
Right. But that technology has been around for a long time. We've talked about it before, but I think the Japanese have been interested in bringing more of their own reprocessing capacity online. And both Japan and France have experimented in the past with sodium-cooled fast reactors to try to deal with some of that used nuclear fuel stream. And now they're looking at less exotic and easier to handle techniques that use better chemistry and better efficiency than the technologies that were around back in the 70s, which also goes to show that if the United States were to ever want to get back into reprocessing, we have about 30 years of technical development to catch up on.
Well, the good thing is that we don't have to go through all of the steps. We can shortcut it and buy what's available right now and start from there if we want.
Yep.
It'd be
interesting to see Japanese technology bought and licensed to use in the United States, kind of like Japanese auto plants.
Sure, why not? Well, you know, there is a fair amount of interest in recycling going on these days. Right now, there's several projects going on as part of the GNEP, the Global Nuclear Energy Partnership, where various consortia are looking at siting a temporary storage facility for used nuclear fuel and then a recycling plant that would be built once there's enough nuclear, you know, used nuclear fuel available to keep the recycling plant in business. And it's interesting to me that the names of the places where some of these studies are going on are very familiar to people who understand or know the history of the nuclear fuel recycling business in the U.S. Morris, Illinois is still on the list, as is Barnwell, South Carolina, as is West Valley, New York, amazingly enough. All three of those
places. All three of which were operating in the 70s.
Yep.
At varying levels of scale. I think two of them were commercial and one of them was a government-funded pilot, but I forget.
As I did some research on that recently, and the West Valley facility in New York was actually an operating facility, but it was the pilot-scale facility. It reprocessed both commercial and government fuels, and mainly it was designed initially to reprocess just commercial fuels. But even the first stage of the nuclear industry in the U.S., went a little slower than what people expected. After the shipping port reactor came online, it was several years before there were more than a handful of reactors that were operating. And quite honestly, the West Valley facility came online and there was no fuel to reprocess. There was nothing left over from the operating reactors yet, or at least there wasn't enough to keep it busy. So they had to reprocess some government fuels, which were significantly different fuel form and caused the cost to increase rather dramatically. The Morris, Illinois facility never actually got running very well, and the Barnwell facility hadn't even been commissioned by the time it was shut down as a result of the presidential order to stop recycling. They called it reprocessing, and the idea was that it would somehow prevent the rest of the world from recycling and would keep separated plutonium off the world's markets.
And now with the new technologies, that concern is being addressed in a much better way. But again, it sounds like back in the 70s they overbuilt those plants for a demand that was wildly optimistic at best.
Before recycling businesses of any kind can start, there has to be a fairly significant volume of raw material ready to be processed. I mean, if you build the facility and then you're waiting for your raw material, you've got all this capital sunk in, you've got people ready to work, and nothing to work on. So you have to wait till you get a installed base of material. And the good thing about nuclear fuel is we've been carefully separating it, inventorying it, putting it in nice containers, and you know, basically getting it ready for ultimate movement, ideally, or the nuclear industry always thought that we were just going to bury it underground, but or at least they've thought that for the last 20 years. But a better thing to do is just to move it all to recycling facilities, probably more than one, be my guess.
And ideally have those recycling facilities distributed around the country so that no given material has to travel all the way across the country.
But yeah, I'd probably cite three.
I went out and bought my newest three compact fluorescent bulbs this weekend,
uh-huh.
And I am basking in the light of 52 watts of goodness, where previously in this heat shielded fixture that's sitting over my head there was about 200 watts of incandescent. And other than a somewhat different cast to the color, it's a little bit more green
mm-hmm.
than it was before, but it's still distinctly yellow. And it's funny because I originally bought a pair that were marketed as daylight bulbs. These were bulbs that emit at a color temperature of 6,500 Kelvin.
Right.
And put them in thinking, okay, these will be kind of like the true color bulbs that you can find. I'm not going to mention trade names, but if you look at them, they're incandescent bulbs that are purple in color.
Right.
When you take them out, and that helps filter out some of the yellow and shift the wavelength of the light that's produced toward the blue end of the spectrum. So I figured, hey, I'll try these and plug them in and turn the room blue. So you have to be careful about what types of bulbs you get and where you get them, but they're also making them smaller and smaller. And I saw what appear to be fourth generation CFL bulbs are now on the market. and these bulbs are something like for a 60 watt equivalent, which is about 13 watts. The actual Curlicue bulb is roughly the size of a Demitasse cup, maybe about an inch and a half long by an inch and a half in diameter. So they're getting small.
Interesting. How much did you pay for your bulbs?
I paid just shy of $8 for three 100 watt equivalents that consume 26 watts apiece.
That's not bad. I've always thought that the amount of savings from the compact fluorescence is somewhat overstated because it generally depends on how much time you leave the light on, and unless it's a bulb that you have burning all the time, I think sometimes they overestimate the savings. But it's not a bad thing to do the best you can to reduce electricity. I just think sometimes the easiest thing to do is turn off the darn light. But
yeah, I mean, I take great pride in having the darkest house on the street.
It's funny. When I was a kid, my father was very careful to teach us to turn off the lights when we left the room. And I always kind of was curious about that because Dad worked for the power company, and I figured he got a discount or something. But later in life, he told me, "Rod, I just know how much we have to put in to make that light come on." And
I guess my primary motivation is not just the power savings are nice, but what's nicer is the fact that after I put these bulbs in, I don't have to put a new pair in again for another 5 years. And I have 9-foot ceilings.
Yeah. Well, that's a good
thing. It's a pain. It is a pain to change light bulbs in this house.
I'll tell you, you talk about light bulbs. I once visited Thomas Edison's home in Fort Myers, Florida. Actually, I visited there several times because it's a pretty inspirational place. But it's interesting to find out that there are bulbs that are burning in that home that have been burning since Thomas Edison lived there.
Yeah, I just heard recently it was on, there's a television program on Discovery Channel in the United States called Mythbusters that I watch every week without fail, which is an extremely good science program and also has lots of explosions and lots of geekery. And they actually went out to a firehouse in Livermore, California, which is just outside the Bay Area where they're stationed, where they operate. And they've had a light bulbs hanging from the ceiling in this firehouse that's been burning for something like 111 years. Something in the late 1800s, very early 1900s. So it's been burning over 100 years. It's a big old copper filament. You can see the filament is quite thick compared to modern bulbs. And it's interesting to look at how the bulb design hasn't fundamentally changed, but it's changed in a lot of subtle ways.
Yeah. Well, the filaments are definitely different than they were back then, and I think that we've worked very hard to minimize the material in those filaments and thus make them significantly more fragile than they were when Edison first developed the light bulb.
Yep.
And of course, that's a good razor blade theory for any business to try to make sure that you sell plenty of your razor blades.
Yep.
I'm sorry. I'm just a cynic at heart, my friends. Okay. Hey, I used to run a small company, and I understood the value of having products that were essentially disposable. It was nice to keep people busy because we had to keep making them.
Especially when you're dealing with materials on those scales. It's just there are some things that it pays to recycle, like nuclear fuel and aluminum, and there are some things that if you look at the energy costs, it may be a something that makes you feel good to do it, but recycling, you always have to do the cost estimate, and you always have to run the numbers.
Yeah, but the problem is so many people in this day and age believe that perception is reality, and I definitely disagree. I am fond of saying reality is reality, but anyway, hey, another good piece of news came out from the Nuclear Energy Institute. Record low production costs for U.S. nuclear power plants. In 2006, the average production cost from the 103 operating reactors in the U.S. was $1.6 $0.06 per kilowatt hour and compare that to the average production cost from a natural gas-fired facility of $0.075 per kilowatt hour. Let's translate that into megawatt hours. That's $16.60 versus $75 per megawatt hour. Now, which would you rather buy? Nuclear electricity or gas electricity?
When you cast it up to megawatt hours, it hits people in the pocketbook a whole lot harder.
Yeah, for some reason, you know, people can't seem to tell the difference between 16 cents and 75 cents. They just figure it's less than a buck, whatever. But when you start talking about this in quantities that people or companies buy, that's a significant difference. That's a, yep. Okay, that's, I would do the math in my head, but my head's not functioning too well today. But it's a significant factor difference there.
Yes.
And of course, there will be people that say, well, you're ignoring the capital cost. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that the capital costs of anything are highly variable depending on project management, the time delays that are imposed upon the project from outside sources, interest rates, a whole bunch of other things.
Numbers look significantly worse if you allow the interest to fester in the background while you're forced to redesign your plants over 5 years.
Yeah, and it's not only interest festering in the background. It's the fact that you've got people employed that are not actually producing anything while they're waiting for something to be approved. And you've also got the revenue that you intended to get from the plant delayed by many years. So all of those things add to the eventual cost of the plant.
In terms of, I spoke about aluminum earlier, and this is a perfect example of an energy-intensive industry. And, I mean, I grew up in a household that was powered, in essence, by the aluminum industry. Both my parents worked for Alcoa when I was a kid. And I remember hearing stories about the pot rooms and never really having a good picture in my mind up until very recently when I went and found a article that was on a site talking about some simulation and optimization studies that had been done to improve the economics and decrease the power requirements to run an aluminum-reducing cell, which is called a pot.
Mm-hmm.
And a pot is essentially a giant electrolysis bath of liquid aluminum with molten fluorine rock sitting on top and mixed in order to provide protection from oxidation and to drive the chemical process. And the voltage is only 6 volts, but they put something like several thousand amps through this bath of aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And since it's the amps that kills you on the power requirements, if you were to say that a ton of aluminum costs $200, which it doesn't, but if you were to say that it does, only three of those dollars come from the cost of material, the cost of the bauxite. The other $197 would come from the cost of the electricity.
That's why aluminum plants are generally located in places where there's hydroelectricity. I guess that's why you lived in upstate New York. Huh?
Yep. Yep. It's one of the very largest hydroelectric plants was built as a joint program between Canada and the United States back in the 50s on the heaviest or the most easily dammable north-flowing river in the Western Hemisphere.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it was just an aside. I was thinking about aluminum the other day because, well, I am a geek.
Well, you know, you mentioned aluminum. I lived in Charleston, South Carolina, and back in 1989, there was a big storm named Hugo that came through, knocked out power for a couple of weeks. We had one aluminum plant located on a hydroelectric dam, and of course, it lost electricity, and the pots froze.
That's not good.
No, it's not a good thing.
Because it takes forever for them to get going again, and they consume many, many, many megawatts. I mean, that's probably the highest power the highest electrical power densities that human beings routinely work around.
Yep.
The magnetic fields in the pot room were so high that they would tell stories about people who did not heed the warnings about not bringing anything iron past the double doors. So they'd go in and then they'd have like a butane lighter in their back pocket and it would slowly work its way out of their pocket. And then it'd get free and make a slightly curved arc because it was following a magnetic field line path and end up welding itself to a wall.
Wow.
And many, many, many dozens of meters per second, if someone were in the way of something that even that large, the size of a lighter, it could very easily have knocked them out or seriously injure or kill them. And that's just something that weighs a couple ounces.
Hey, there was one other thing I wanted to mention before we get cut off here because I'm going to get kicked out of this building. But last week in Houston, the Cambridge Energy Research Association, or Research Agency, what is CERA? Anyway, that group, which has always been very heavily populated by oil industry folks. It's started by Daniel Yergin. It's had folks like, I can't remember all the names.
Daniel Yergin of the Prize fame?
Yep, yeah. But anyway, they had a conference, a bunch of energy executives, and apparently, based on some podcasts I've heard, like the Platts Oil podcast, the major topic of conversation was the incredible prospects for growth in the nuclear energy industry. I thought that was pretty interesting. In fact, I figured that you might want to hear the excerpt from the Platts Oil podcast. So here it is.
This is Craig Moore, web editor at Platts.com. I'm speaking with John Kingston, global director of oil for Platts, who has just returned from the Cambridge Energy Research Associates annual meeting. The oil day was on February 13th. So what were your impressions of the meeting?
Well, the meeting was packed. I mean, that was one thing. This is my 10-year anniversary. The first meeting I went to was 10 years ago, and it's grown substantially in size. It's obviously, with energy so much in the news, it's a meeting that draws a lot of media. The media room was packed. CNBC broadcast live from there. So this is a very, very significant meeting, and CERA draws in very top-notch talent to speak. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, spoke. David O'Reilly, the CEO of Chevron, spoke as well. A lot of focus on climate change, of course, with the acknowledgement that obviously oil and energy in general is contributing to climate change. There seemed to be a general consensus among the speakers I heard that there will be some sort of significant step taken by the U.S. in coming years to try to limit carbon emissions. It might be a cap and trade system. There was definitely no sense that there would be significant taxation to try to restrict fuels that contribute to carbon, a view that nuclear obviously has a very bright future. So that was one step, one very big topic of discussion.
Now back to our conversation.
Yep. And unlike what you blogged about this earlier, but this is something that bears repeating. Venture capital and traditional capital are interested in getting a banker's ear if you're going to consider putting up new nuclear plant proposals. Is not quite as easy as, say, hey, I know how to program and I can put up a website during the dot-com era, but it's starting to look that way.
Well, of course, there's not a whole lot of folks that are trying to do startups in the nuclear industry. But anyway, I guess I got to sign off. I guess it's time to sign off. Take care, man. Bye.
Bye.
And so we had to come to a rather abrupt close to Atomic Show number 50. That's what happens when you're borrowing bandwidth from a public facility and they decide it's time to close the doors. Anyway, hope you all enjoyed the show. Have a great week. And please come back and listen. If you want to contact me, you can contact me at rod_adams@atomicinsights.com. You can find the Atomic Insights blog at atomicinsights.blogspot.com. You can come visit this website at atomic.thepodcastnetwork.com. And you can find lots of other interesting and unique niche shows on the podcast network. And here's a promo from one of my favorite shows on the podcast network, The Cranky Middle Manager Show. It makes me feel very much at home, since that is often where I am in my day job.
Hey, everybody. This is Wayne Trammell from the Cranky Middle Manager Show. Who says business podcasts can't be fun? It's management, darn it, not the priesthood. Okay, managers sometimes get more respect than we deserve, and sex between coworkers is strongly discouraged, but it does happen. Okay, it's a little like the priesthood. But anyway, listen to the show. We'll have some fun. We'll talk to the top authors, managers, and experts from around the world. The Cranky Middle Manager Show, cmm.thepodcastnetwork.com. Don't let the weasels get you down.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.